Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining me for this podcast today. Neuroplasticity is the brain's ability to alter its structure, but also its function in response to new learning or changes in the environment. Therefore, when it's said that the human brain is plastic, it means malleable, and it means it's able to change. Now, this might seem impossible, but your brain is constantly changing from the moment that you are born. Each time you learn or experience something new, synaptic connections and neural pathways are formed, and the more that you use them, the stronger they become. The less you use the neural pathways, the weaker it becomes, until eventually that pathway just gets deleted in a process known as synaptic pruning. It's quite an interesting name there. This demonstrates how the brain is constantly changing as an individual learns and then subsequently forgets. It's during infancy, that the brain experiences its most rapid changes. In response to everything that a child learns, from walking and talking to learning the faces and recognising the voices of its caregivers. It was previously thought that the brain could only change during this critical period of infancy. However, new research suggests that the ability for the brain to adapt actually remains with that individual for the rest of their life. So, as the title suggests, what I want to do in this podcast is look at this idea of neuroplasticity and functional recovery of the brain after trauma. So let's start by looking at some of the research evidence into this idea of neuroplasticity. Well, the case study by Maguire and team back in, I think it was 2000, demonstrates plasticity in the brain really quite well. Researchers examined the unique brain structure of London taxi drivers who were required to learn all of the roads in London and the surrounding areas in order to be able to navigate around them successfully. The researchers completed MRI scans of the brains of around 16 taxi drivers and 16 non-taxi drivers as a control group. It was found that the average size of the hippocampus in the brain was significantly larger in the taxi driver group compared to the control group. Additionally, the longer that the taxi drivers had been working, the larger their hippocampus was. Now, that supports the idea that the brain is really plastic, as the tough demands of the taxi driver's job had a physical effect on the structure of their brains. Neuroplasticity has also been demonstrated in many pieces of research, and two of them I'd like to just mention now. So Elbert's study back in 1995 investigated the structure of the brains of musicians to see how continued practice and environmental stimulation would affect their brain structure. Musicians who played string instruments were given an MRI scan, and their brains were then compared to the brains of the control group, so obviously non-musicians. It was found, as expected, that the musicians had a much larger somatosensory cortex compared to the control group. It was suggested here that the increased sensory processing required by the musicians to play the instruments resulted in structural changes in the brain, again showing support for the theory of neuroplasticity. Draginski's 2006 study investigated German medical students during an intense period of revision for their medical exams. Students were given periodic MRI scans throughout that revision and exam period, and it was found that during periods of intense revision, the amount of grey matter within the students' brains increased significantly, and additionally, they were found to have larger parietal cortex and hippocampus regions. However, 3 months later, their brain showed no further structural changes. The great amount of information learned within the short revision period could have caused that. The structure of the brain changed based on the environmental input, again, showing evidence for neuroplasticity. But how does functional recovery of the brain after trauma come into the kind of story? Well, how is it that a child can have, say, half their brain removed and still be able to function normally? Well, that's exactly what happened to, in the famous case of EB, an Italian boy who had a brain tumour removed at the age of 2.5 years. Surgery also resulted in the removal of virtually his entire left hemisphere, including his Broca's area, and as a consequence, he lost the ability to produce speech. Afterwards, he completed an intensive rehab or rehabilitation program and eventually started producing speech again at around the age of 5. Now, Danelli and a team of scientists back in 2014 tested EB at the age of 17 and compared his language abilities with controls, finding that his right hemisphere had compensated for the damage and he was able to produce speech very, very well. Although this is one famous case study, which does cause problems of, generalizability, it does demonstrate that the brain is able to remarkably repair itself after injury. And this is known as functional recovery. So it's all related to this idea that the brain is able to change, structurally change and adapt to things that ultimately happen to it. Environmental changes, if you like. Now, functional recovery of the brain after trauma is about how the brain manages to, as I've said, adapt and repair its structure and functioning after suffering damage, such as in the case that I've just described. Now, it's been found that the brain can recover after different types of damage, including head injuries, strokes, tumours and infections, all of which can result in a loss of function. Through neuroplasticity, the brain is able to change in order to compensate for the loss of function. Psychologists are still unable, though, to pinpoint exactly how the brain regains that lost function or functions. Two theories have been put forward that I'd like to, comment on now. The first is the idea that the brain is able to rewire and reorganize itself by activating and taking over existing but rarely used neural pathways close to the area that's been damaged in order to regain that functioning. Additionally, new synaptic connections may be grown to link these areas of the brain in a process known as axonal sprouting. The axon is the long extension of the cytoplasm of a neuron or a nerve cell. So axonal sprouting is this kind of growth, if you like, or the forming these new connections. Second theory is that in some cases of brain damage, the equal but opposite area of the brain to the damaged one may take over functioning. So for example, if Broca's area in the left hemisphere is damaged, then the corresponding tissue in the right hemisphere may take over speech production. So what about factors that affect recovery of the brain after trauma? Well, although it's possible to regain function after a traumatic brain injury, the extent to which function can be regained depends on several factors. So let's take them one by one. Age. Well, it's already been noted that the brain grows and adapts the most during infancy, and it's able to adapt throughout a person's life. However, with increased age, the extent and the speed of recovery after trauma changes as neuroplasticity becomes increasingly difficult as a result of the brain's just natural deterioration. Studies found that patients over the age of 40 regain less function after brain damage and that the function had been regained was, I guess, more likely to decline in the 5 years that followed the brain damage compared to a control group under the age of 40. Now, that does suggest that age is an important factor in functional recovery. Then there's gender. Research suggests that women are more able to recover from traumatic brain injury compared to men. And that could be because women's brains are less lateralized, if you like. So Ratcliffe and a team back in 2007 studied over 300 patients with brain damage and tested their responses to rehabilitation, both at the time of the injury and a year afterwards. Now, it's found that women did significantly better a year later on cognitive attention and language tests, although men performed better on visual analytical skills tests, if you like. And it was concluded that due to the superior functioning in the women's group, that gender, or biological sex, if you like, rather, may be a significant factor in determining how well the brain is able to recover and recover function, particularly after injury. Schneider in 2014 looked at education as a factor. So his team investigated participants who had suffered head injuries to discover whether their levels of education affected recovery. A fascinating study. It was found that 39% of participants who had completed an undergraduate or postgraduate qualification were left free of disability, compared to just 10% of participants who made a full recovery and had failed to complete high school. Now, it was suggested that people who are more highly educated have an increased cognitive reserve, as it's referred to, meaning that basically they're more likely to retain function due to an increased cognitive capacity. So that suggests that a person's level of education is influential in functional recovery. The work that's been conducted into neuroplasticity and functional recovery has been key in developing practical techniques for helping brain damaged patients in what's known as neurorehabilitation. After experiencing brain damage, the brain may start to heal itself on its own in a process known as spontaneous recovery. However, after an initial period of improvement, recovery generally slows down, at which point intervention is required in order to gain back as much function as possible. Now, there are several types of neurorehabilitative therapy, but in this podcast, I would like to focus on one, constraint-induced movement therapy, or CIMT. Now, this is typically used with patients recovering from strokes. Strokes commonly cause one hemisphere of the brain to be damaged, which consequently causes a loss of function on one side of the body. The brain is described as being contralateral, meaning that the left hemisphere controls the right side of the body and vice versa. Therefore, if someone experiences a stroke which damages their left hemisphere, they may suffer from full or partial paralysis in their right side. Now, CIMT, or constraint-induced movement therapy, prevents patients from using their functioning side, and it forces them to try to use the paralyzed side in an attempt to make the brain, if you like, relearn how to work it. Investigators Wolf and Winstein looked at the use of intensive MT for recovering stroke patients. The patients were required to try and use their paralyzed limbs for up to about 6 hours every weekday for 2 weeks, with their fully functioning hand restrained. Their functioning was measured before and after therapy, and it was found that all patients actually made improvements. And so it was concluded that CIMT has benefits in aiding the functional recovery of the brain after trauma. But as I've described, the biggest contribution of research into neuroplasticity has been into developing neurorehabilitation therapies for patients with brain damage. It's been demonstrated to be highly effective in helping patients to recover following a stroke, as in the study that I referred to. And this is a great strength of neuroplasticity research. Although the research outlined in this podcast does suggest that the brain is able to regain function after injury, it's also important to note that participants' level of functioning was only tested after their injury. Now, due to the nature of the case study method, participants were unable to be tested before their brain injury, and so we can't make an accurate estimation of how well they have regained function, as there's no initial measure to compare it to. So this suggests that the results gained on functional recovery research might not actually show the increased gains that they suggest, and as such, it's a really big limitation of the research. There's also problems with generalizability in all brain damage research. There's a multitude of factors which can affect recovery, including the location and severity of the damage, plus individual differences such as age, gender, medical history, which makes each case of brain damage unique. So that suggests that results regarding recovery of brain function can't actually be widely generalised. It's also been suggested that neuroplasticity is the cause of the disorder phantom limb syndrome, which some of you might have heard of. This is where people who have undergone limb amputations experience feelings in their non-existent limb, which could range from a mild sort of tingling sensation to extreme pain. It's thought to be a maladaptive consequence of neuroplasticity. So the idea is that when a limb has been removed, the area of the brain controlling it becomes less active, and as a result, the brain experiences cortical reorganization, if you like, in the somatosensory cortex, which causes those abnormal sensations. Although it's still argued that there could be other factors influencing the development of phantom limb syndrome, if neuroplasticity is involved, then it really does demonstrate that neuroplasticity may not always be beneficial due to these potentially maladaptive consequences. I think really to conclude this podcast, I think we can all agree that the brain really is quite a remarkable organ. And although a few of its abilities have been described in this podcast, the truth is that scientists are learning more and more about how the brain changes and functions every single day. So do you know what, to that end, and to further your own knowledge, it's definitely worth staying abreast of contemporary, particularly psychological research, as the reality is that there's still a lot more to learn about the brain and this idea of neuroplasticity. On that note, I'd like to say a big thank you to everybody for listening, and I'd like to thank our sponsors, Curriculum Press, for providing content for me to use for this particular podcast. As always, if you have any questions about any of this material, do get in touch at kytosbiology@gmail.com. Thanks again, and until next time.